The conversation of your life, local, relevant, digital, and always on.
America will hear my two cents.
Elected to serve iHub radio listeners across the desert cities. He calls it as he sees it.
Quick question.
Now, here's Russ Betts.
Someone answer him now!
Okay, it's hour number two on the Russ Betts Show here at iHub Radio in beautiful downtown Palm Springs. The weather's gotten a little cooler, but wow, 59 degrees out there. Well, I know if some of you listeners in other parts of the country are thinking 59 sounds a whole lot nicer than what you got going on, and we agree. You know, it's nice out here. I like blue sky and sunshine, and it's going to get up to, what's supposed to be 76 today, something like that, I think is the forecast. So, hey, we'll take it. We love it. All right. You know, I'm going to get off. I'm going to go ahead and cover some of these details going on in Hong Kong for you. I've got a little bit of personal perspective on that, having lived in China and having friends there now giving me some details in this great article that we got out of the Daily Signal. But first, I want to take a moment. I got in my car today, getting ready to come down here, and as soon as I opened the door and sat in, I said, wow, somebody left something in the car. And what was left in the car was the smell of camping. My grandson and I went out and decided to do a little camping over the weekend. And, you know, it was fun. It's good time got away. The computer was put aside. The cell phones weren't out. We did stuff like, you know, playing in the creek and throwing rocks and him trying to push me in. Didn't succeed. But there's that unmistakable smell of camping that lingers in a car. It's magical. And it also is your memory. It's like, wow, that was a fun time. And you don't realize it smells like camping when you're out camping, but that, I don't know, it's like rain, the first rain that's falling, and you smell that. Well, camping's got that same distinct, the smell of the first rain, the smell of camping in your car when you get back. As crazy as that sounds, it just, you know, I got the car, wow, that was a really fun time. It's good to get out. You know, we're so blessed here in California. Besides this weather we got going, it's not a long drive to go somewhere and be out in nature. And we're out there. We saw a coyote coming down to the creek to get some water. And, you know, we're playing around. We're looking around. And, you know, we could see civilization nearby. But we're off in our own little world. We're having a good time. And you don't have to drive far. You can go to the beach pretty darn quickly. And if that doesn't suit you, you don't want to play around on the surf, well, heck, go up to the mountains and enjoy the snow. California's got it all. But the point is, get out, spend some time. It's a short drive. Here in the Coachella Valley, there's just all kinds of places you go. Mission Creek is just a beautiful, natural day trip to go and see what's water flowing through the middle of the desert. Even in the summer, when it's 110, 115 degrees out, there's this creek that runs nonstop. And you just go wade in it, and it's a great time there. And Whitewater Preserve isn't far away, and they do the roads back open. You get up the Idaho Valley, get out, enjoy. Things are good. All right, Hong Kong. The headline in the article says they're willing to die. What an American in Hong Kong sees, and the interviewer is Rachel Del Gaitis, and the interview appears in a publication called the Daily Signal. And they're interviewing a guy named Cody Hodgshell. I guess that's how you pronounce it. Howdshell. We're just going to call him Howdshell. That's his name. And, you know, they asked him, so right now you're on the ground in Hong Kong helping the freedom fighters, giving them emergency first aid. Must have some medical background. Can you set the scene for us and tell us what you've witnessed day to day? So he goes on, he says, when I first arrived, he arrived on November 1st, you could walk around the streets during the day and you would think this was just a normal city. He said there were protests, but they were typically on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday nights. And during the daylight hours, it was business as usual. So protests in the evening and, you know, the rest of the time, everything's just going about its, you know, normal business. He said it was almost surreal walking around in the morning, seeing everything going on as if nothing happened the night before. But he said the night before, you saw tons of rounds of tear gas fired and pepper spray and violent clashes between police and protesters. He says, but even back then when he first got there, the violence wasn't quite as high as what he's seeing now. It's ratcheting up. And he's saying it would be nice if things de-escalated, but he doesn't see that happening, that things might de-escalate. He thought things might de-escalate in the first week, but that hasn't been forthcoming. It's gotten worse. He said in the last 10 days, with the universities being placed under siege and fortifying themselves. Have you seen that video? If you go look, you can get some live feeds on this where you can actually watch the stuff going on. And all it is somebody with a camera just pointing it and showing you what's going on. No commentary. You get a little bit. It's in Chinese, Cantonese, not Mandarin. So if you speak Mandarin, you're not going to be able to follow what they're saying very well. I don't speak Cantonese, and with Mandarin, I at least pick up some of it. But anyhow, just basically, you could just see what's going on. And you look at these videos, and the students have basically barricaded themselves inside the universities. And what they were doing was they would do a volley of activity, and then the police would move in to prompt the students to start doing whatever it is they were, throwing at them. And then they would back off. And then the police would advance, and then the police would back off, and the police would advance, police would back off. And what a friend of mine in Hong Kong was telling me is that they're doing this to try and, every time the police would charge, the students would respond by releasing whatever weapons or objects they had to throw or whatever else. And the police were figuring, hey, every time we do this, they unload some of their arsenal, so let's just keep doing this back and forth. Advance and retreat, maybe we'll wear them out of stuff. Well, eventually the students were getting pulled out of these universities one by one. So the universities are under siege. And he said it's just, it's gotten to the point where the violence has escalated and the clashes are a lot more regular, to the point where it's been 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's not just Friday, Saturday, and Sunday nights anymore. And so he said the past 10 days, it's really been at a peak as he's walking down the street. He would typically pass one area where the protesters were building roadblocks. And then they tear up bricks from the cobblestone sidewalks. They work them loose, and then they're paving bricks, and they use them to throw in the road, or they stack them in the road. And I guess they've actually been getting mortar or something. Hey, go down to the building supply. We've got all these bricks, and they're starting to build proper walls as barricades. I don't know if you've ever been to Hong Kong. They don't use metal scaffolding. They use bamboo scaffolding tied together. It's the most incredible thing you've ever seen. 20 stories up, and it's all bamboo scaffolding just tied together. And so they've been taking the scaffolding down and using that to create barricades. So then you walk to another block, and you would see police fans coming in, and they would set up their lines, and they would have their face off, and, any other stuff's going on. And, this is some of the detail you get about what's going on there. They got certain protocols that the police have to follow. And I can't, this just sounds funny to me, but the police raise a blue flag that's a signal. This is an illegal assembly, and you must disperse. So some policeman stands out there waving a blue flag. It's not the bullhorn. Hi, you must disperse. This is a blue flag that gets raised, and it means you must disperse. And if that doesn't work, then I guess if nobody leaves, what happens next? Where'd the blue flag go? I lost my place here. I'm sorry. All right. Well, they got an orange flag and a red flag, and I guess you can guess what that means. They ramp stuff up. All right, so if nobody moves after they've raised the blue flag, then they're going to fire tear gas. If nobody leaves, then they fire the tear gas. Then they raise an orange flag, and that's saying we will disperse or we will fire. And when they fire, what they mean is they're going to fire rubber bullets and sponge rounds and beanbag rounds. They don't mean actual live rounds. So, then through the night that goes on where the protesters and the police face off, rounds are exchanged, the protesters are throwing these bricks besides just building the walls. They've been throwing a lot of Molotov cocktails, and they're using catapults, slingshots. I saw something on there where they're actually using bow and arrows, and then the police are returning fire with tear gas and rubber bullets. And the protesters gain some ground, the police gain some ground, just keeps on going on. So these kids, you know, the police, they're weighed down. This is an observation this guy makes. The police are in their 30s, and they're weighed down by all this heavy equipment. And what they're facing is kids that are 16, 17, 18, and 19-year-old. And when the police come, they just take off like high-speed rabbits. I mean, they obey the police and they disperse, but then about an hour later, they regroup again. And it's really hard for these old guys with all this equipment, relatively old, 30s, to catch these young teenagers. And so that's what's going on. And there's just, this is going on. So he says, definitely to poke and prod the police and antagonize them and then withdraw and then do it again and withdraw. And, you know, these tactics of people who are really equipped to using bricks instead of organized like the police are. So he said, you know, there's a vast amount of the population keeping the police busy in the streets while the university students had the opportunity to fortify the universities. And then when those battles happened on Tuesday, the Chinese University of Hong Kong became ground zero. And right now, and then it's close to the Poly University, Polytechnic University is also in the middle of all this. And so, you know, the interviewer asks, so the protests in Hong Kong, they started the original ones more than actually 6 months ago. And what they started it over was an extradition bill, which that started the process. Now, they don't explain in this interview what the extradition bill was, but what originally got this going was the Chinese government said, hey, you know what? If you get caught in Hong Kong committing an offense, we're going to bring you into mainland China and you're going to go through the justice system there. Well, everybody in Hong Kong said, no. We like the justice system here. What they have, you know, England, Great Britain occupied Hong Kong for, 99 years under the treaty. And they didn't just bring themselves, they brought what's called English rule, the court system that all of us would recognize. Now, here in the U.S., you know, where you get read your rights, you don't have to say anything, you get a lawyer, you get a proper trial, a fair trial. That didn't happen that way in mainland China. There's a whole different philosophy to that. In Hong Kong, they rely on individual rights protections, and, you know, if you're not guilty, you're going to get a fair trial. In mainland China, it's a little different perspective. I call it a fatalist view of the justice system in China, that the typical mainland Chinese would accept that if you ask them, well, they caught this guy, they say he murdered somebody, and it wasn't long before they put him to death. What if they got the wrong guy? And the mainland Chinese people will basically tell you, well, you know, that's the cost of the system. There's something you have to accept with. That's fate. Sorry, you're innocent, you got caught, and that's just the way it goes. Well, if you're under the English rule system, that isn't just the way it goes. You expect to have your rights and protected through the court system, especially when you're accused of something. That's what the English brought to Hong Kong. Chinese mainland China was threatening to take that away through these extradition type events. So we're going to get a bit more of this when we get back. We got a few other things I need you to hear. This is Russ Betts on iHub Radio in beautiful downtown Palm Springs.
Read about it tomorrow. See you tonight. Hear it all day today. If it's happening in the Coachella Valley, it's front and center now on iHub Radio.
And there it is.
Now, here's Russ Betts.
Okay, so the protest in Hong Kong started over something that was called an extradition bill. And that bill said that if you commit a crime in Hong Kong, rather than staying here and going through the court process in Hong Kong, you'll be extradited to mainland China and you get to enjoy the privileges of the mainland Chinese criminal court system. Well, a whole bunch of people in Hong Kong that are guarding their freedoms and liberties and say, no, we like English rule. We like the English court system is a great gift to the world, what the English brought as far as protecting individual liberties all over the world. Many places, Singapore, lots of places can thank the English for that. We can. Hey, our legal system was founded in English rule. But mainland China is a little different story. You know, they got a fatalist view there. That's what I call it, a fatalist view of criminal justice. Hey, you get the wrong guy, well, you know, sorry, that's the price. That's just the way it goes. Tough luck, buddy. You know, off to the stadium you go and you're executed. Hong Kong didn't like that, so they protested. And the protesters ended up actually getting their main demand met. They said, you know, end this extradition bill. And finally, after some, you know, consternation, the Hong Kong government said, okay, the extradition bill is tabled. We're not going to do that anymore. We got you. We understood. Well, that should have been, in my mind, that should have been the end of it. You press, the Chinese Hong Kong government lost face. They put something through as an initiative. Bad idea. Shouldn't have done it, but they did it. And then when they had all these protests, they resisted for a while, like people do, normally do. And then they said, okay, you're right, fine, we'll table that. Celebrate your freedom and go home and keep your guard up and watch for another day. But this guy who's being interviewed here, Houdshell, he says, I don't think the extradition bill, once it got going, remained their main demand. I mean, it started out that way. But all of a sudden, they realized, hey, you know, we got some power here. We got this. Let's see what else we can get. Well, what they got now was the mainland Chinese government saying, you know what? You got a major concession. That wasn't enough for you. And now we're going to start putting you down. Well, it comes in measured degrees. I mean, it doesn't come all at once. They don't just roll in the tanks. That might come later. And believe me, if China wants to come in and squash all this, they can. I think they're taking a measured approach, but it's definitely ramping up. And you see some protesters are getting rounded up, and whether they wanted to be extradited or not, you can guarantee that's where they're going. Once the police have a protester in custody, they're not going to the Hong Kong court system to say, hi, well, was it really you? And, you know, like you see going on here in the U.S. and other places, they're going to mainland China. And police says, hi, this guy was protesting in Hong Kong, causing all the commotion. The judge says, oh, yeah, well, sorry, off to jail you go. So, and this guy says they're willing to die for the cause, but they got to know what their cause is. So anyhow, they said, well, once we're doing this, we really ought to be demanding what we fully deserve. And I guess what they want is full universal suffrage, which means they want to have a legislature in Hong Kong that they actually vote and put there, that's elected by the people, democratically elected. You know, when China took over Hong Kong government, some things did go away. And so now they're putting these demands. And there are five demands the protesters have, the extradition bill being withdrawn, that was done. And then the second biggest one was the universal suffrage, meaning, hey, we want direct elections, we want full representation, you know, representation by the people here in Hong Kong, and a fully democratic governing system. And so that's it. We don't know how this one's going to end. It would be a massive concession on the part of China to allow them to have fully democratic government. They don't have that in China. They got one-party system, and people don't know. They actually do have elections in China, but it's like who's going to be selected to be in the central governing party? There's just one. You don't get Democrats and Republicans and all those squabbles. You got one party, and so, you know, everybody thinks China is a communist country. That's, you know, communism is so far buried in China. There's nothing near that. It's a one-party system. And you talk to some people from China, they're real happy to have the one-party system rather than all this commotion we got going on. I mean, are you sick of all this stuff going back and forth in this country with the two parties battling it out? In China, they say, hey, you know what? We got a great economy. This is good. What do I need to fight this out? So anyhow, we'll have to see what happens. There's, you know, they're starting to throw Molotov cocktails. There's rumors, this guy says, who's on the ground, of IEDs and being made, and that's no longer a protest. It's a revolution for freedom and democracy. And, you know, it's a huge step, and you got to weigh your opponent there, and these protesters, these students that are digging bricks out of the sidewalk, fighting the Chinese mainland government on principles as much as direct elections. They already caved once. If it sounds like I'm advocating they need to back off, regroup, and let things tone down a little bit, I think that would be in their best long-term interest. This all rivals what happened in Tiananmen Square back in the 80s, which I'm going to talk about in just a minute. But we got some other people that want to share with you some great messages, and we're going to get to those. And then we're going to come back and we're going to wrap this conversation in Hong Kong and China up with talk of Tiananmen Square and some perspective on what it's like to live in China, not just Hong Kong. This is Russ Betts on iHeartRadio in downtown Palm Springs.
The conversation of your life, local, relevant, digital, and always on.
America will hear my two cents.
Elected to serve iHub radio listeners across the desert cities. He calls it as he sees it.
Quick question.
Now, here's Russ Betts.
Someone answer him now!
So we updated this look on Hong Kong with an answer to the question, or at least raising the question, how will it end? How will mainland China deal with a bunch of scrappy kids throwing bricks at them and protesting and seeking full democracy? That's what this is about. They're waving American flags and seeking full democracy in Hong Kong. And the guy who was interviewed on the Daily, what was the name of this publication? The Daily Signal. His name is Cody Houtzel. He's been on the ground in the thick of it, and he got to this interview. He came to the same conclusion. China is their enemy, really. So it'd be very hard to battle and win. You know, you get a bunch of scrappy colonials beat the biggest army and navy back in the 1770s, talking about the American Revolution. So he's thinking maybe possibly they have a chance. I'm not going that far. I mean, look what happened in Tiananmen Square. It's almost the same exact playbook. And you had the students who were wanting opening up at the time. And China back in the 80s was a much different situation. They were just starting to open up and see the rest of the world. Nixon had been there and visited, and they were starting to open up. A little bit of democracy was starting to creep in with it's getting rid of the collective farms and the climbing out of the horrors of the Cultural Revolution, and the students were wanting something more, so they took over Tiananmen Square. And Russia, I think it was Gorbachev, was coming there for a state visit, and typically the Chinese had held their big events for visiting heads of state in Tiananmen Square with all the pomp and circumstance that goes with one of those big events. That's a huge place. Tiananmen Square is a big, big place. If you've been there, you see it's just a big expanse, and they've just put on this great show. Well, Gorbachev was coming in, and they said, okay, good, you got some concessions. We gave you some concessions. Now disperse so we can put on this event. And then, we'll pick up discussions later. Well, that didn't happen. The students said, no, we're not leaving. They went on a hunger strike. Some say that caused them to be irrational. And so the Chinese government was forced to go to an alternate, lesser location, which was a big embarrassment. And, in China, face is a big thing. Don't underestimate face in China. I lived there for 8 years. I know there's certain ways you have to deal with this. You really got to be sensitive to it. Well, the students that were occupying Tiananmen Square weren't sensitive to that, and they also weren't sensitive to the fact that there were hardliners who were sitting there giving the softliners in the China government some slack, saying, okay, fine, do it your way, but if this doesn't work, well, after they had to relocate that ceremony for the visiting Russian president, the hardliners said, that's it, we had enough, we're rolling in the tanks. And so that's what they did. They dispersed it, and it was a big, big show of force. It's hard for us in the U.S. to appreciate that. We look at that. We see that iconic picture of the guy standing in front of the tank saying, no, we want democracy. And, you know, we think, well, we sympathize with that guy. We think democracy is great. It's what we want. We want the English rule. We want the freedoms. We want all this. But the, you know, the mainland to mainstream Chinese middle class people just going about their daily lives, wanting a better economy, wanting better living standards, wanting to grow out of poverty and have their karaoke machines in their houses and their cars and everything else that they want, same as the rest of us. They all had a little different experience than we've had in this country. They lived through the Cultural Revolution. And that was a horrible, horrible time, a time of horrors in which students took over with some really zany, crazy things that inflicted a lot of pain and misery on a lot of people. And I'll just give you a couple examples. I got family members who lived through it, specifically my wife. And you're, you know, somebody knocks on the door and says, hi, we got this new program. We want you to see what it's like to be a farmer. So you and your eldest daughter or eldest son can go up to Beijing and you're going to be farmers. And her family had a position of some import in the government, you know, connected government-wise. And, well, that wasn't a good thing to be. And so off they went. And I guess my wife tells that her oldest sister was whinging, didn't want to go. So she says, oh, it's all go. So she goes off. Next thing you know, they're living in a dirt floor hut, farming and everything else. And, you know, the crazy part was the farmer. They didn't just send people off to be farmers. The farmer went down to the city and became a doctor. And he, you know, he put on a white coat. He's got his really rough farmer hands. You know, he's been digging in the dirt. They're all calloused and rough. And so he's there wearing a white coat. And all of a sudden, he's a doctor. So, you know, you're sick. You go see the doctor, and the doctor prescribes. He says, oh, let me look you over. He says, okay, well, I want you to take this and this medicine. Go down to the pharmacy and get it. And you go, okay, well, thanks, doc. I appreciate that. And you leave. Well, pretty soon, somebody's knocking on your door. Hey, we noticed you didn't pick up your prescription. He said, well, you know, the guy was a farmer not long ago. I don't think he knows what he's prescribing. I really didn't want to put that in my body. He said, well, you're going against the social order, and I don't think that's a good thing. So you get down to that pharmacy, and you go take this medicine. And, you know, it was things like that. Or at the start of it, women getting on a train who had fancy hairdos. I mean, you go back to the fashions of the time. And they were told by students, hey, don't get on this train. You got a fancy hairdo. You need to get rid of that fancy hairdo. Fancy hairdos are no good. And at first, the woman would just brush them off and go in. Well, pretty soon, they'd have them blocked. They couldn't physically get there. And then they'd have a barber chair sitting over there. And a woman would have to go get her hair restyled into a simple, you know, non-updo style haircut, or she wasn't going to get on the train. And then it got crazier than that, you know, coming into your house, stealing all your possessions, not stealing them, though, just taking them out, piling them in the street and burning them. So anyway, I just went into all this craziness. And so if you live through that and, you know, great personal tragedy of re-education camps and people coming back from those mentally ill. And, you know, I saw that, too. You know, the family members that, you know, who had been off, just had a really hard time of it and came back not well. So you go through all that, and then you look at these students, you say, hey, you know, quit causing so much commotion. Students are supposed to be in school studying, not protesting. That would be a common view that you would get from many people in China. And you think, well, how could that possibly be? Don't they want freedom? And yeah, they want freedom, but, you know, if freedom is what they went through before, and, you know, they're pretty much free to go about their lives as they want. You know, they got this terrible court system that is a fatalist court system. They can get grabbed and mistakenly accused of something and don't have much chance in court. But, you know, a lot of them, millions and millions and millions of them are climbing their entire, you know, the entire population of the U.S. is 330 million, something like that. And that is the Chinese middle class is like 500 million. And, you know, they're saying, hey, you know, times are good. And they got huge amounts of disparity in wealth, especially with the industrialization of China, then becoming the world's manufacturer. But anyhow, they're just not so anxious to rally behind a guy standing in front of a tank. They're saying, hey, don't get this started again. So we look at it through a little different eyes. You know, and it's really fun to watch how the police handle stuff. And you see this stuff in Hong Kong where they're talking about, there's got these riots going on, and the police sit there and raise a flag, a blue flag, says, "Hi, listen, let you know, we're getting ready to come in, and then we're going to start firing stuff at you." And then they got an orange flag, says, "Okay, now we're sending non-lethal rubber bullets and beanbags at you." I mean, they actually signal them with a flag. And if you see a policeman who's got a confrontation on the street, and maybe he's pulled the guy over, and the guy's tired of being pulled over, and, "I'm not going to pay your ticket," and he starts giving the policeman guff, I mean, he'll sit there, you watch him. This guy who got pulled over is just cussing the policeman upside, you know, up one side and down the other. And you would think in the U.S., you know, they don't take too much of that. You start spouting off like that, and you're out of the car on the ground in cuffs, and, you know, well, they decide to get you to calm down. But in China, the police officer just sits there and he salutes. This guy's just yelling at him. He sits there and he salutes. And I'm watching from my apartment this whole scene unfold. The guy just keeps going and keeps going. He didn't know when to quit. And so the policeman finally said, "You know what? I had enough of you." So they take the guy and they put him in the back of the car. It wasn't the back seat of the car. It was actually the trunk of a hatchback. They just threw him in the trunk of a hatchback and shut it. And then there was six of them just standing around talking. You can see one guy looking at his watch and saying, "Well, do you think he's been in there long enough?" And somebody, you know, another one of the officers say, "Nah, let him stew in there a little bit longer." So finally they go over and they unlatch the thing, and I'm wondering what's going to happen. And this guy gets out of the car and he just walks away. He says, "Okay, I got the message." And he just took off, left his car there, and he walked on away. He got out of there. He figured, "Phew, that was close. I took it a little too far." They didn't do that in Tiananmen Square, and they don't seem to be doing that in Hong Kong. You know, some other things that are different. I served as a consulate warden for American Citizen Services out of the U.S. consulate in Shanghai. It's a volunteer position to help Americans that get into trouble. And, you know, I dealt with some things from minor to serious. One time a guy's in his hotel room and he calls me up. I knew him. And he says, hey, the police are inside my room here. And they're packing my suitcase, and I don't really understand what's going on. I don't speak Chinese. Can you come over? Now, I speak Chinese, but not well enough for that situation, so I brought my translator over, and so Kathy's there with me, and I said, "Well, what's going on?" They said, "Well, you know, he was walking through the street with a girl of the night, and the police went up to him and tell him, 'Hey, you really shouldn't be with her.' And instead of saying, 'Oh, well, thanks for the advice,' he took off and ran." Well, the police know where you are. They knew where he was. They knew him. But he took off and ran. So he says, "You don't run from the police. You run from the police, guess what? We're coming to your hotel room, and we're going to pack up your suitcase." So my translator explains all this to me, and he says, "Oh, that's interesting." He says, "Well, you know, you got Guanxi. You could probably get this guy some reprieve." I think, "Yeah, all right, yeah, that's good thought." So I called up somebody in the town where I had my factory. I said, "Hey, I got this situation going on," and the guy, you know, Mr. Yu says to me, says, "Well, you know, we could probably do this, but you really want to spend that Guanxi. You don't get unlimited favors." Guanxi is basically favors, little chips that you carry in your pocket. I said, "I don't know. Let me call up his boss." So I called up the job foreman, and I sure hope this guy isn't listening, because, you know, I could tell him what happened. And I called up John, and I said, "John, I got Mike here, and the police are packing up his stuff. I guess they're going to take him to the airport and send him back to the U.S., what do you want me to do?" And he said, "Oh, man, that guy is such a jerk on the job site. Let him go." I said, "Okay, fine." Hung up the phone. I said, "I'm sorry, Mike. There's nothing I can do. I guess you ran from the police and you shouldn't have. So you're going home. They're packing up your suitcase. You're done." He goes, "Oh, wow." So they packed up a suitcase and away he went. Now, I dealt with some more serious situations. A guy was lighting off fireworks and blew his hand up. And he ends up in the... they took him to the hospital before they told me which hospital. And every hospital there is numbered 1 through whatever, 8. You know, hospital 1, hospital 2, hospital 3. They're just all numbered. So I didn't know. I finally got to the 3rd hospital. I walk in, and there he is sitting at the admissions desk. And he goes, "Oh, Russ, when are they going to see me?" He's a little bit in shock. And I take 3,500 renminbi, the Chinese currency, and I plopped it down on the desk, and they whisk him away. If you don't have cash, you don't get treated in China. So anyhow, deal with that, and then a couple other evacuation cases. I don't know, I'm getting off on a tangent here. Sorry, it's Sunday morning, I can ramble a little bit. One guy, he had medical evac. I'll tell you, get evacuation insurance when you're overseas. He got on a plane, and he got to go back for his medical care. The entire flight to himself back to the U.S. Another guy didn't have evacuation insurance and had to arrange for operation on him. in the Chinese hospital. So, all right, we're back with some more. We're done with Hong Kong and China. We're going to get into some other stories here. Get it back local. This is Russ Betts on iHub Radio in beautiful downtown Palm Springs. More to come.
Live from the Palm Springs iHub, he calls it as he sees it. The Russ Betts Show. Call 760-544-TALK. Now, here's Russ Betts.
All right. We dedicated quite a bit of time to what's going on in Hong Kong and perspectives in China. And I just want to wrap that up with one additional note here, because we tend to view the world through our own experiences and think that everything else is that way. And if you look at Hong Kong, you can very simply reduce the whole situation over there to, well, you got freedom fighters going against mainland China. But you also got something called the triads. And I remember I was in Hong Kong, and we're all sitting at the pub, and we look and we see three police officers running like crazy. I mean, they're running as fast as they could go. We thought, oh, they're chasing somebody. And then on their heels, and about 30 seconds later, or 20 seconds later, is 10 guys in black suits, 6 guys in black suits running, chasing those 3 cops. And what happened was, is the Hong Kong police went in a little too far into the triad-controlled territories and were getting chased out. And those police were running for their life. Now, that was all before mainland China took over. So you see that and you're thinking, okay, you know, people living here got the triads and the, you know, black society covering what's going on there. And the mafia, whatever you want to call them, the gangs, and they don't, people living there don't like that. And so, you know, you heard the story at the time of China. As soon as they took over, they sent 6,000 police into Hong Kong. Now, you can sit there and say, well, they're coming there to influence their dominance and take over and turn them into a nasty communist country. Or you could sit there and say they're providing some much-needed reinforcement for these police that are running scared from these triads that control parts of Hong Kong. So anyhow, not everything is as you perceive it. And I remember the first time I'm going over there, I'm flying into Chinese airspace. I've got Newsweek magazine that I've been reading. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm going into a communist country. Maybe I ought not take this magazine in. I hadn't finished reading it. So I left it in the seat back of the airplane. I thought, oh, some Chinese worker is going to get this and maybe steal it out and it's contraband and go read it, secretly read it. So anyway, I go through customs and I'm going down the escalator. And they got the airport malls look just like ours, and they got gift shops. And I look, and right there at the gift shop, right at the front of the rack, is the very same Newsweek magazine that I was reading. I thought, okay, you know what? Things aren't as they tell us on CNN. And, you know, as I lived over there, that's one thing you learned is that, man, don't believe the BS you hear out of the network media trying to tell you what's going on overseas in China. I mean, CNN was the most unreliable source you could possibly imagine. And when it came to news on China, and you just sit there and go, oh, shaking your head. All right, I promised there was other news. And we've got to bring this back local in a little bit of time we have left here. Marijuana breathalyzer technology is here, and it's coming for drivers. Well, maybe. I dig in a little deeper. These headlines, they seem to tout one thing. But when you get into the story, you find out it's not quite as definitive as the headline says. Who are these headline writers out there? You know, there actually is a college course in journalism for headline writing. It's something they focus on teaching you. They're not doing a good job from what I can see, because they're sitting there saying the technology is here, but as I read this article, it says, well, it's sort of here. They haven't quite gotten there yet. But anyhow, marijuana users have a new reason to think twice before getting behind the wheel. And you got researchers at the University of Pittsburgh they admit the blood test is still considered the gold standard for testing for marijuana, and also same with urine and hair samples, but they have hope of a new technology that will help police identify impaired drivers, people driving under the influence of marijuana. That's a far cry from marijuana breathalyzer technology is here. The headline's wrong. That's it. Officially, it's wrong. Anyhow, apparently this thing, if you blow into it, it looks like a regular breathalyzer, can determine if you've got marijuana in your system. And Pennsylvania DUI law states that any amount of marijuana in someone's system is considered a DUI because marijuana is still a Schedule I drug on a federal level. And if you know anything about this, you know it lingers in the body for a long time. I mean, 2 weeks later, you can have it show up in your blood or your hair or whatever else. So unlike alcohol, when a driver is considered impaired at a certain level, it's 0.08 in Pennsylvania, I think it is in California as well, there's no level yet set in which the driver is considered impaired on marijuana. They said they still need more studies to work on it. Proof again that the headline's wrong. Anyhow, just take this as they're working on it, all right? I'm going to call this one grief that a council member gets. I'm remind you again, I'm a council member in the city of Desert Hot Springs, and I came across some articles that said that 45% of the cell phone traffic is for robocalls, those junk calls that we all get, and they've tracked it. In October alone, there were 5.7 billion robocalls placed in the U.S. I think half of them must have come into my phone. That's 182 million per day, 7.6 million per hour, and 6 million per hour. That's 2,100 per second. And the average U.S. resident receives 17.3 robocalls in the month of October. I'm getting four or five a day. I don't know what I'm doing wrong, but the rest of you are getting 17.3 in a month. So anyhow, it's up significantly. It was just 4.5 billion, only 4.5 billion in September. Now it's up to 5.7 billion in October. And in March it was so the number just keeps going up. But so the point I made as a council member is that, you know, we're approving these cell towers and I'm thinking to myself, you know, nobody likes cell towers. Everybody recognizes that to some extent they're a necessary evil. They emit radio waves. A lot of people are very concerned about that. And so, yes, I get it. You know, cell towers emit radio waves. They're a problem. They're a nuisance to look at. I mean, we go to great efforts to make them look like palm trees to hide them. They still don't look the same, but it's a better job. Everybody knows that cell towers are a nuisance, but we all need them for our cell phones. But the point I was trying to make is that 45% of the cell towers out there are only serving, if you look at the numbers, are to accommodate the cell traffic. We could probably use 45% less cell towers if we didn't have all these robocalls coming through that nobody wants. So if you're concerned about emissions of radio waves from cell towers on your health or unsightly cell towers, then you should have another reason to be irritated at robocalls, which is the point I was trying to make. But if you're a council member, it just goes with the territory. Somebody's going to pick apart what you say, and you don't have forever to say it, but there I tried. Well, this article I'm looking at says 10 cities that received the most robocalls. We don't need to go into that. You can go find that online. Atlanta, Dallas, New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, Houston, Baltimore, New York, Newark, New Jersey, Phoenix, and San Francisco. In order. If you didn't get that, go look it up. And, wow, cannabis taxes going up. I wanted to get to that one, but once again, we are out of time here on the Russ Betts Show on iHub Radio. It's been good being with you. Wow, 2 hours goes quick. I can't believe it. It got me awake. It's Sunday morning. I'm awake. I'm ready to go off about my day. I don't know what I'm going to do today. Maybe clean the garage. I hope you're going to have a good day out there. The weather's not too bad. It's certainly way better than what they got going on back east. So enjoy it, California. Enjoy it, Palm Springs. We're back here next week on the Russ Betts Show on iHub Radio. And, well, that's it. We're done for the day.